On March 8th and 9th, 2010, Cleveland Right to Life launched the first annual Bringing America Back to Life symposium and exhibition dedicated to the entire spectrum of issues that make up our journey to pave the way to a full understanding of the sanctity of life in our culture. Through prayer, action, voting, and education, we will pave the way to achieve this goal. We know you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our roster of 12 fine speakers who, with their thoughtful, lively, expert presentations, eloquently defend the right to life.
Well, good morning. You know, Molly asked me to give a talk, and I mean, if it were up to me, I would probably talk about the Academy Awards today. But when I brought that up to Molly, I got,
"No, Raymond, I think we've heard quite enough about all of that. I don't think anyone even saw Avatar, Raymond. No, the assigned topic, and I hope you'll stick to it, is the media and its role and the role it plays in making us aware of the life issues. Just stick to that, all right? All right?"
I said, "All right." So, now you know what I'm going to be talking about. I don't mess with Molly. And I have to thank my friend Molly Smith. She has done, as many of you know, such an astounding job here, bringing this community together and making people aware anew of these important life issues. And I come to you today and I want to offer my perspectives as a broadcast journalist and reflect a bit on how life is reflected in the media and the impact it's having on these important issues. The job of a broadcast journalist, truly, is to see reality and to bring a true depiction of that reality to viewers. Now, we deliver gorgeous and horrible truths to the world each day. Everything from a toddler surviving an earthquake to Nancy Pelosi. I'll let you distinguish the horrible from the beauteous. But many of us, I think, allow our blind spots to interfere. And at times we miss many, many important stories. At times we journalists can be like that 80-year-old couple I once heard about. They were forgetting things, terribly forgetting. And they went to the doctor and they said, "Doctor, we can't recall where we live at times. We lose addresses. We forget what we're doing." And he said, "Well, this happens. It's part of age. Write everything down, if you would. Just write down what you're thinking at that moment. You won't forget." So they go home that evening, and the wife turns to her husband and says, "You know, I'd really like a little bowl of ice cream." "Don't worry, I'll get it. What do you want on it?" She says, "Strawberries. I'd like strawberries on." "Strawberries and ice cream. What kind of ice cream?" "Vanilla ice cream." "Vanilla ice cream. Strawberries, vanilla ice cream." She said, "Write it down." The doctor said to write it down. He said, "Look, I can remember. Vanilla ice cream, strawberries." She said, "Put some whipped cream on top." "Whipped cream on top, strawberry, vanilla ice cream, strawberry." And he goes in the other room. 20 minutes later, he comes back with a plate of eggs and bacon. And he gives it to the wife. And she says, "What happened to my toast?" So you see, some people, no matter how many times they remind themselves, can lose sight of reality. And we have to, I think, cling to it. And in the case of human life, we're ignoring reality is what's happening at this moment. We are missing the objective reality of the human person, and that's quite, quite dangerous for us, not only as a culture, but as a people. The pop culture teaches us that some lives are not lives, while others are disposable. The media itself can at times objectify the person, turning him or her into a commodity, an entertainment, not quite a human being. Think of the celebrity culture that we see all around us. This past week, we've been treated to a healthy dose of the celebrity culture and the build-up to the Academy Awards. Think of people like Paris Hilton, Kate Gosselin, David Hasselhoff. These are people that kind of drift in and out of our consciousness. And we kind of see their horrible choices. And, you know, these are things we discuss around the water cooler. We ridicule them. We make light of them. But they're not quite people when you think about it. We sort of ignore the soul of these poor people. And I think all of this, in an odd way, contributes to the devaluing of life, to a cultural diminishment of personhood, to an objectification of human life. And it's no wonder that personhood itself, something so basic, so elementary, should be questioned, but it is. It is an open question. Malcolm Muggeridge, the great English journalist and writer, once said, either life is always and in all circumstances sacred, intrinsically of no account. It is inconceivable that it should be in some cases the one and in some the other. And he's right. Life is either sacred or it isn't. And journalists, like so many other citizens, are out of sight, out of mind people. If we don't have visual confirmation of something or someone, we tend to disregard it. And I think this partially explains why the tragedy of abortion gets so little coverage. It is a silent, unseen tragedy. The remains of the child are taken away. The mother is left with her private scars. Consistent with that central thrust of Roe v. Wade, even the painful after effects are private, a matter of privacy, subject to that so-called right of privacy. Now, not only the unborn, but people with various disabilities are similarly depersonalized, devalued. The odd thing is that at times, though these people can be seen and sometimes heard, because they don't look or sound like we do, they're disregarded, stripped of their dignity, considered a burden. Think of Terri Schiavo, woman who was there, living, loving, offering love to her family, but considered a burden. She wasn't able to fully communicate, and that became the justification for hastening her death. Look at Mother Angelica these days. Last time I saw Mother a few months ago, she's confined to her room. She can't leave the cell any longer. She needs constant care. She can communicate a little bit, but not much. Now, when one looks at her and sees that radiant smile and that joy, for many, that isn't enough. They place a pretty low value on her quality of life. But I know, and the nuns will tell you, and I dearly believe, that the success of EWTN, the continuing success over these last 9 years while she's been confined to her monastery, suffering the after effects of a stroke, in that suffering, in that oblation, in her constant prayer, which she continues, that is the source of any success that the network has had and that, quite frankly, the work I'm a part of has had. How can we place a value on that? It's the mystery of the cross. It's the mystery of suffering, offered up to Christ and united with his suffering. And yet we as a society would cut that short, cut that moment of grace, cut it short. And I think it's short-sighted. The other day when I was with her a few months ago, she was lying there, and as I said, she says a little bit, but she'll smile. You come into the room, she certainly recognizes you. And we were talking, and she was laughing, and they told her another party was coming to visit. And I said, oh, that's, and they said, Raymond, is it okay if we bring this other person in? I said, oh, sure, that's fine. And I said, I was sitting there with her. Well, the moment she heard the door open, she shut her eyes. And this other person came in and went into a whole song and dance, and they're going on. And Angelica didn't move. She just, and this person said, I guess she's sleeping. She looks like she's tired. I said, yeah, I think she's tired. I said, she's probably tired. And they got up and they left. I said, okay, mother. They kissed her and left. The moment they left, eyes pop open. So she can still play possum. And the spunk is still there. But again, we can't evaluate the quality of another life. We don't know what God's doing with that life or using that life to accomplish, even in suffering, even in pain. The latest book I edited for Mother and her monastery came out last week. It's a collection of her prayers and personal devotions. But these are things that she prayed starting here in Canton, Ohio, on Euclid Avenue here, when she entered the monastery. Some of these are time-tested devotions. Others are prayers in her own words, immediate prayers, little arrows of prayers she sent up. And they're very personal and practical. There's also this long, impassioned, elegant, kind of stark, dark night of the soul diary that she kept. It was the only time in her life she kept a prayer diary. And I put it there because I think it indicates, even when internally we feel abandoned or alone or as if we can't give or receive love. It is in those moments where God might be purifying you, calling you to something greater, using that moment for your sake and for others. And she writes about this in very deliberate and honest ways. And eventually she pulls out of the darkness. But it's that travel through the dark that I thought was instructive, because today we have many frail elderly like Mother, people suffering with various disabilities who are in that same type of darkness. Maybe not a spiritual darkness, but a human darkness where they're ignored because of their condition or thought to be less than. And I don't think any of us should dare to attempt to qualify or quantify those lives. Throughout the recent healthcare debate, there have been voices, some of them within the administration, suggesting that the elderly should be denied care or certain treatments for the good of society. That's the only way to bend the cost curve. It makes sense. It makes sense. Seniors are where we spend most of our money. And it is when people are approaching the end of life that they need care the most. And those treatments can often be expensive. Now seniors have been targeted, some of them stripped of their personhood, diminished by virtue of hanging around too long. And there's something profoundly disordered about that. And the news flash is, and I don't think people even consider this, what we do to grandma, our kids will do to us. One would think they'd kind of wake up and see that. It's like that great Stephen Sondheim lyric from Into the Woods. I don't know if you know this show, but there's a great couple of lines there. And it says, careful the things you say, children will listen. Careful the things you do, children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children will listen. Children will look to you for which way to turn, to learn what to do. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen. And I believe children are listening, and they are seeing. I'm a surveyor of culture, someone who places far more emphasis, I think, on the power of pop culture, the power of the arts, to shape our future than politics or the law. And I think we have to become increasingly aware of that indicator. I see pop culture as a great indicator of where we're going. Now, there are many areas where it's a depressing, bleak picture. But when one talks about life and how the culture is regarding life, there are reasons to celebrate and, I think, to have hope for the future. I want to point out some examples. There's an MTV show. Some of you in the back will probably be more familiar with it than some of these folks in the front. It's called 16 and Pregnant. I don't know if you've seen this. Now, it is not Masterpiece Theater, okay? Let's be honest. It's kind of a gritty reality show, and it introduces us to girls who find themselves in crisis pregnancies, and they wrestle with the challenges facing them. Many of them, most of them, at least the episodes I've seen, they make the right choice. They choose life, no matter the difficulties. And somehow, through family, friends, or outsiders, they're helped in their decision. This is good. There's something uniquely bubbling up, I think, in the pop culture. And to have a program like this on MTV is nothing short of remarkable. Because it shows the consequences of the debauched flesh parade that MTV usually broadcasts. It is a bit jarring, I have to admit. It's almost a shock when you're watching MTV's coverage of spring break and suddenly here comes 16 and Pregnant, you know. It's like waking up from a 7-hour drinking binge and, you know, the sunlight cuts into the room in the morning and you're kind of, you know, it's very stark and you wake up real fast. It's the consequences of that kind of detached living with no sense of responsibility. And it's good. It's good that it's there. During the Super Bowl, there was the much talked about Tim Tebow ad. The Heisman winner's mother was advised to have an abortion. She ignored that advice and raised not only a great athlete, but a stand-up guy. And though I thought the ad was a little odd. Did you see this ad? It is a weird ad, I'll admit. I mean, the mother is standing there, blah, 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 boom. She gets hit. The son comes and knocks her down. I thought it was an advertisement for hip replacement health insurance or something. I didn't know what it was. But the fact is, and what I loved about it was it unleashed a particular cultural moment that I think was pro-life, because for the weeks preceding it, there was this dialogue in the media. Oh, they're going to have to air this Tebow. It's terrible. And all the hand-wringing. And there was, again, an awareness that there are children, innocent children, whose lives are on the line. And that was part of the conversation. The invisible was made visible in the culture. And that is good. And my saints won that day. More importantly, maybe. No. Then there are a series of films over the last few years that have done a remarkable job, I think, of raising the issue of life through comedy, farce, and drama. Now, this is not out of Africa either. Let me make the disclaimer. But it shouldn't be ignored or diminished, because it's clear proof that the young audience and filmmakers who are particularly attuned to that audience understand where we are at this moment. And I'm referring to films like Bella and, to a far greater degree, Juno and Knocked Up. These films underscored in their quirky way, and you know they're not Woody Allen films, I know, but they show in a quirky way the beauty of life and the personhood of the unborn child. Knocked Up was particularly successful in depicting a couple who find themselves pregnant, and in the midst of the potty humor and the foul language that accompanies the scene, they used an ultrasound as a plot device. There were shots of the baby growing within this girl that kind of punctuated each of the scenes as you went along. The power of that image, the scene revealing the hidden life on screen, on the big screen, in cineplexes, in the midst of comedy, is a good thing. And the media alone is capable of having this kind of evangelical outreach to the very heart of the culture, which is where you want the message. You don't want it confined to living rooms and to conferences like this. The message is going out. Now, Molly, I don't mean to contradict you, but I'm now going to talk about the Academy Awards. Up, which is the great animated film. I hope some of you saw it. If you didn't, you should. Up was probably the best picture of the year. It was redemptive. It was uplifting. Beautifully done. I didn't even want to see it. My children dragged me to see it. But it won best score last night. But it tells the tale. It celebrates, really, the wonder and the adventure of every age, particularly old age. And in it, you see an older man at the end of his life about to embark on the last great adventure of his life. And he's accompanied by a young boy, a little scout, who joins him for the ride. And in its tender, subtle way, it underscores the brevity of life and the joys of generations cooperating, the value of old age, which I think a lot of people missed when they looked at that film. But it's there. It's there in bold relief. Sandra Bullock, who won the Best Actress statue for The Blind Side, which was another great pro-life film. Southern family adopts this ignored black boy who's homeless, takes him into their home, and he ends up being this amazing NFL football player, nurtured by love and support from this family. She said when she accepted the award, "I'd like to thank what this film is about for me, which are the moms who take care of the babies and the children, no matter where they come from. Those moms and parents never get thanked," she said. It's important to have those ideas and sentiments broadcast over those sorts of platforms, and they are being broadcast. Again, these are subtle, tiny indicators, but they are indicators, I believe, of a national heartbeat for life, and it's progressively beating stronger. In California, a 20-year-old UCLA student, Lila Rose, goes around the country with hidden cameras, and she files these web-based exposés of Planned Parenthood clinics. Now, as a journalist, I have to be honest, I don't entirely embrace her particular approach all the time. But, there is no doubt, she's a fearless young woman, intent on getting the story. She poses as a minor when she goes into these Planned Parenthood clinics. And in repeated instances, she tells these people working in the Planned Parenthood clinics that she has been sexually abused by an older male. And in case after case, state after state, clinic after clinic, she's videotaped evidence of them bending the rules, hustling her to an abortion, and covering up the fact and not reporting the fact that she's been a sexually abused minor. In Birmingham, Alabama, she did this just, she was on an EWTN show, I think, and was in town and thought, oh, I'll do a sting operation. And she went into the Birmingham Planned Parenthood Clinic, and now the state of Alabama has put these clinics on probation because they violated not only the state's parental consent law, but they also failed to report the sexual abuse. And because of the length of these recordings, I mean, she went to several clinics and got different people saying the same thing. It has really built the case that there's something profoundly wrong in this industry and the push to get these young girls onto the abortion table rather than helping them make a fully informed choice. She's really exposed them. Now, if Lila Rose were doing sting operations at a meatpacking plant or uncovering corruption among government officials, they would give her a Peabody Award. But the fact that she and this team of young people feel so motivated through their convictions to launch this kind of guerrilla journalism is an indicator of where young people are. They are the survivors of the abortion age, and they recognize themselves as such. In Washington, D.C., the cause of Bart Stupak and his band of pro-life Democrats has been getting incredible coverage. They are threatening to derail the health care legislation unless it has prohibitions on funding abortion by the federal government. I think they're serious. I think they're committed to standing the ground. But the pressures upon them are intense at this moment. To defy your own party, to look the president in the eye and the leadership and tell them, we won't move on this issue, this is a core principle for us, takes real guts. And they seem to be standing firm. I'm not convinced they won't cut a deal. Not them, but the administration. They're going to try to use maneuvers, I think, to massage the pro-lifers. We'll see what happens. But for the moment, they're standing firm, and there's a group of them combined with the Republicans. It looks like they have the votes to stop it. In the area of embryonic stem cell research, now talk about unseen lives, ignored lives. There are thousands of lives in suspended animation sitting in freezers right now. In California, you'll remember, in 2004, they had a proposition, and it set aside, the bankrupt state of California set aside, $3 billion to fund embryonic stem cell research, untested research, research that has bared no real, tangible fruit. And yet they doubled down on it. This past year, and it got almost no coverage, California began diverting their $3 billion of funds to adult stem cell research. Now, why? Because the embryonic stem cell research hasn't done a thing. It hasn't cured anything after all these years, since 2004. And they've got to have something to show for this money. So they're quietly sort of funneling the majority of it. 71% of the money is now going to adult stem cell research. This is a crucial, major victory that no one's reporting. Nobody's talking about. Meanwhile, adult stem cell research is curing diabetes, spinal injuries, Parkinson's, amazing breakthroughs discovered ethically without the difficulty of taking human life, without crossing a moral barrier that we should never cross. This is a cause for celebration, and the polls are looking up. There was a Marist poll that the Knights of Columbus conducted earlier this year. It found that only 51% of baby boomers say abortion is morally wrong, but 59% of millennials aged 19 to 29 say abortion is morally wrong. 60% of my generation, the Gen Xers, say it's wrong. The tide is turning on the issue, and the younger generations, are leading the way. This is a cause for celebration. So many of you who've been laboring in this field since Roe v. Wade passed, keeping the flame alive, the flame is now an inferno and it's spreading, and you should know that. And pat yourselves on the back for it, because I know it's been a long, lonely struggle for so many of you. But the light is coming. That light you see is the flames burning across the nation of young people who get it. Before I go, I want to discuss media coverage of those of you who support and defend life. If there is bias, and perhaps there is, I believe it's caused by ignorance and pain. Now, I don't believe that all journalists are hardened partisans out to destroy life. I don't. I do believe, though, that through personal conversations with many journalists, they've told me, they've simply never encountered pro-life people. They don't run in these circles. They've never met pro-lifers. So they accept the stereotypes that have been branded upon pro-lifers by the other side. With no data to counter that stereotype and no contact with anyone in the pro-life community, they accept the characterization and they move on. The fringe anti-choice zealots are out pushing some whacked-out agenda to limit the choices of women. End of story. Now, that's where it is. As evidence, look at the coverage of this year's March for Life. It is the largest continual march in Washington's history. Some estimates this year said that as many as 300,000 people attended the march. Children and families and women and old folks and young folks and schools. It was an amazing outpouring. Another march was held on the West Coast this year. A record number of people showed up. All over the country, they had local marches in cities and municipalities. Did you have one here? Yet, a national movement, all these marches, this activity on the same day, hundreds of thousands of people, ABC, CBS, NBC did not file one story on any of it. None of it. Not one national story on the major broadcast networks. Now, when there is a health care bill hanging in the balance, largely due to the debate over abortion funding, how could you not cover a story like this? I mean, journalistically, it's a huge blind spot. It's negligent. NPR did file a piece, however. They interviewed Sarah Foster, who's the head of Feminists for Life, and an abortionist who called pro-lifers terrorists. So, that was something. There was more revealing coverage, I think, though, on CNN. Their online story for the day read, Roe v. Wade anniversary marked by vigils and demonstrations. And the picture at the top of the story had five pro-choice women holding up placards in front of the Supreme Court. Five. Now, they had five in the picture because I was there. There were only five protesters at the Supreme Court. Now, what I loved was later that day, the anchor Rick Sanchez was watching the live footage coming down. He's seeing hundreds of thousands of people streaming by. They're there carrying placards, the whole thing. Pro-life placards. I'm pro-life, you know. And he said, and I quote, which side is represented the most here? Do we know? I guess the big banner with Nellie Gray holding it saying March for Life might have been an indicator of all the people behind. So, but distinguishing five from 300,000, I guess, is a tough call. But I see this as a symptom of ignorance, really. And I mean, the poor man, he was... Since then, every radio show across America has called the poor man out. I mean, he was ridiculed for it. But it's a symptom of ignorance coupled with preconceived ideas that never get challenged. The bishops of the U.S., in a reflection in 1995, Faithful for Life, observed, when those who adhere to a belief in the sacredness of life express that belief publicly, in their words, public witness and peaceful protest, we bishops are heard among them, as we have been heard on workers' rights and civil rights and in the struggle for peace, urging prayer, nonviolent and even exemplary witness that respects every single human life. In today's media landscape, to get that public witness out, to make that voice heard, it will require a much more savvy approach. And this is the next challenge, I think, for the people in this room and anyone who's concerned about this issue. Marching is not enough if no one knows you're marching. You can march from Noddle Doomsday. It's important to get the message out. The personal stories, I believe, are the things that will break through. That is the Trojan horse for your message. The personal stories. The woman who made the choice for life against the odds. the child who's thankful for his mother's choice for life, the crisis pregnancy volunteer who now know and help the children that she helped save. Those are great, life-affirming, uplifting stories. And they need to be heard. They should be heard. But you've got to engage the media. And this is where, quite frankly, I think the pro-life movement falls on its face. Engaging the media. There's kind of a fear. There's a trepidation a bit. Get to know reporters. I know they're not great people. I'm one of them. But I'll tell you one thing about any reporter. They love free lunch. Invite them to lunch. Take them out. Schmooze them a little bit. Introduce them to your view. Give them a story. Reporters are also under intense deadlines. It's very competitive now. You see, I'm sure, in this town, like so many others, whole news staffs are being wiped out. So the pressure on the individual reporter is intense. And there's only so much information you can take in. Make his job easy for him. Write the story for him. And what I mean by that is, go to him with potential interviews, or her, with potential interviews, a little conflict, a little emotion, and hand it to him on a platter. Prepackage the story. Produce the story for him. Then he can fill in the blanks and flesh it out. And you become a source for him, someone he can rely on and go to whenever the issue comes up. He also will trust you as time goes on when you pitch him on a story or a new thing you're hearing about. I know how tight many of your budgets are. But there are PR people who are pro-life too, and you should reach out to some of them. See if they'll volunteer their services to pitch your stories and reach out to journalists for you, help place stories for you. There is so much noise out in the culture, and I just think to cut through, you have to be passionate and you have to be available. And oftentimes, we have the passion, but we hide it under the bushel basket. And we can't do that. The story of crisis pregnancy centers and other initiatives like Project Rachel, of individuals involved and touched, these colorful, untold stories are out there. It's time to tell them. And as a journalist, we need to hear the other side of the story. And the efforts to advance it have been pretty woeful so far. The saving grace of this movement, culturally speaking, is you, all of you. You have the young on your side. There they are. From the polling data and the cultural evidence, there is a growing conviction that life is worth protecting and living. And the individual witness of people like yourselves have created this moment and shaped it. And you should be heartened by your advances, cheered by where you are, and hopeful to move forward and make greater gains in this media-saturated culture. And I want to leave you with this, because we have to cling to hope. There were three men who died recently. And you know, when you die, the first thing you do, if you make it to heaven, they have an orientation. Did you hear about this? They have a little orientation. And they ask you, as they ask these three gentlemen, when people come up to your casket, what do you want to hear them say? And the question was asked, and the first man said, well, I hope they'll say I was a great family man. I cared about my wife. I was a loving father. Okay, good. Good. Next, what would you like to hear them say? The man stepped up. He said, well, I'd like people just remember my work in education, how I helped shape young lives, and that I hope they remember me as an asset to the community. I love those people. Very good. Thank you. Sir, what would you like to hear them say? The fellow stepped forward. He said, well, I think I'd like to have them walk up and say, look, he's moving. So you see, hope. We have to cling to at every moment, and that man had hope. And the good news is you all are still moving. You have legions of young people behind you to keep moving, and you will continue moving. There is great hope here. Go out and share this winning story. The world needs to hear it. I thank you so much for having me and look forward to talking with you and seeing you the rest of the day. Thank you. God love you.
We hope you enjoyed this Bringing America Back to Life symposium presentation brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life. Please encourage others to listen to this and the other 11 presentations. We hope you will join us next year in our nationwide effort to bring America back to life. For information about our symposium or for more information about our full set of audio and video products, call 216-661-3000 or visit our website at clevelandrighttolife.org.